Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are asking the question on everyone's lips. Just as we were starting to believe the three-team title race was real, is it in fact all over? We'll also discuss the battle for fourth place, and there will be some chat about Newcastle, Manchester United and Bournemouth too. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have a football writer and Sunday Times columnist guaranteed to bring me sunshine on a Monday morning. It's Alison Rudd. A former footballer who was part of the Millwall team who mercilessly marched to the second division title in 1988, winning the league by 11 points. It's Tony Cascarino. And another former footballer who knows a thing or two about being ruthless at the top after his Chesterfield side took first place after just 19 matches of the 2010-11 League Two season and never got knocked off their perch for the next 27 matches. Gregor Robertson is here too. And that last fact might have been used in last week's disappearing show. But, dear listener, you will never know. Now, team, this is a room in the News UK buildings. Deep, deep in the buildings. There's no windows. It's all dark. And it's packed with two slightly sad, sombre Liverpool fans. A sleep-deprived Scott and a Lincoln City fan who watched his team blow their slim playoff chances on Saturday. So I'm very wary of making sure that we're nice and positive for the listeners before we get into the Premier League title race chat. So let's all start with something that we're grateful for, or that we're happy for, just to lift the spirits. And I'm going to go first. I am very, very grateful for Mauricio Pochettino and his slow transformation into Alan Partridge. It is wonderful. I don't know whether you've seen the comments on the Times website this morning. We have to have balls to win the ball. I mean, what on earth is he? He's lost the plot, hasn't he? Every press conference, and I've said this before recently, you know, reporters ring in and Poch has said this, it's not ever about like his team or something. And I don't know whether he's trying to do some kind of botched Alex Ferguson thing where you take attention away from the fact that your team are a bit crap by making it all about you. But it's heading into parody now, isn't it? It's like, if you read that in a Partridge voice, you have to have balls to win the ball. Come on. There you go. We're all
been working on that all night, haven't
we? No, it's because me and Coogan are from the same part of the world. It just comes naturally. Anyway, so that's me, Partridge and Poch. Anyone got anything else that lifts their spirits this weekend? Tony, you've been on holiday?
Yeah, I've been away. That lifted my spirits.
Got a lovely tan?
Not bad.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Well, speaking as a bloke who can never get past the shade of translucent, then I'd say that's a pretty good tan.
Yeah, and also yesterday's over with, so that's a good thing.
Oh, no. Gregor, what are you happy and grateful for?
I'm very grateful to Ross County.
Yeah?
For beating Rangers.
There you go.
And rocking the title race in Scotland. Don't at me, Rangers fans.
I promise you they will. Also, yeah, Rangers fans, don't at me. You know, like sometimes when you get upset about Martin Samuel and because he's not on Twitter, you would get in touch with me instead. Alison, what are you grateful for?
This sounds a little bit like an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, isn't it? Isn't that how it starts?
Which is ironic given the amount of gin and tonic I've drank this morning just to get through this.
I'm grateful because on the way back, on the train, on the way back from the Emirates yesterday, I got a text from my next door neighbour saying, don't worry, I've checked our shed and outhouse and we've not found any sign of Victor. And I was thinking, Victor's my cat. And I was thinking, why were they looking for my cat? I didn't know he was missing. What was going on? My husband is so obsessed with the cat that he didn't come in for a snack. So he went round all the neighbours knocking on the door saying, can you check your sheds? And under pot plants and check he's not hurt in any way.
And where was he?
He was out having fun in the sunshine. It was fine.
Playing with the foxes.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought you were talking about the foxes. I didn't think you were talking about a normal pet. I thought you were talking about your pet wild foxes.
So, can I ask you a question now? Does your husband love Victor more than you?
Ooh. Oh, yes. If I went missing for an afternoon, he would be knocking on the neighbour's door saying, can you check under your bed, please?
Goodness me, confessionals all around. We're into a relationship. Now, quick, panic. Back to the Premier League title race. Where should we start? Where should we start? Should we go in, you know, chronological order? Start at Anfield? Yeah,
yes.
Let's start at Anfield. Let's get it out of the way, shall we? Liverpool 0, Crystal Palace 1. Gregor, I'm going to have to start with you just to try and set the tone for analysis. Analysis, composed analysis. That's what we want. What did we make of this game?
Crystal Palace were outstanding.
They were bloody
brilliant. Let's just start by saying we don't have to view the world through the prism of Liverpool Football Club. Oh. Crystal Palace, we're outstanding.
I've got to say,
that has been the tone in recent weeks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Particularly with the Manchester United game, it was like
it'll be the tone in about 5 minutes.
Manchester United,
so let's get it.
Focus is to rock Liverpool's world.
I've got to say as well, I'm surprised you didn't for your things I'm grateful for, because I nearly did this as well. I love the defenders high-fiving after a block or a tackle and the goalkeeper and things. You know, that kind of performance, the kind of, yes, get in, I've just done a block on the line. I love it so much as a goal. You must have enjoyed
that. No, I don't like that.
Oh, for God's sake.
That's growing to become far too commonplace. Like, it needs to be really worthwhile for that to happen. In fact, I had a conversation with someone about that in the press box at the weekend. Anyway, we'll move on. I do love watching Eze, and I do love watching Elise, and I love even more when they're both on the pitch together, which hasn't happened enough. And they had, I know this is about Liverpool, but they had chances. It could have been 3-0 up at half-time. And then Liverpool's failings in front of goal reared their head again, particularly in the second half. And some of the chances, I mean, Darwin's on the sort of volley from 6 yards. I know you kind of just try and connect with the ball properly, but
Salah as well. Don't deliberately just mention Darwin.
No, they've both gone off the boil.
They've
both gone off the boil at the same time, which is very unfortunate. Curtis Jones at the end as well. Jota, look, Liverpool could and should have won this game with the chances they created, but you just kind of find yourself after this game thinking all those weeks when we were saying that they were finding a way to pull a result out of the hat, get last minute goals, last minute winners, last minute equalisers, whatever. Ultimately it wasn't sustainable.
That was the strange bit for me watching it. And Alison, I'm going to come to you on this because obviously this has been the theme of their season. But it struck me that watching this game, as it went on, it felt more and more like they wouldn't necessarily score. Like the chances became a little bit less clear cut. They were a bit more kind of lob balls into the box. There was a period on a counter-attack, I think, where Palace had quite a few players forward. And I think the ball broke to Trent Alexander-Arnold about on the halfway line. And he kind of just spun and like whacked it forward without any real kind of class or composure. And that's not specific to Trent Alexander-Arnold, but it just felt like it all got the fevered nature of Liverpool this season, which has been brilliant, all just got a little bit out of hand and a little bit lost and confused. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. There's a point at which chaos is beautiful and something to be jealous of if you don't have that ability to pepper an opposition goal and have the crowd willing you on. And then there's a tipping point, and then chaos becomes, it becomes chaos without the beauty attached to it. So that it did feel a bit desperate. I still felt Liverpool were dangerous from corners. Their delivery from set pieces was good. There were some well-delivered crosses in open play that should have been put away. And in that second half, it wasn't that Liverpool were abysmal or without a plan, but if there is a plan, the plan is that sense of overwhelming the opposition and just having an optimism that you're going to make it count, so that when it doesn't, it never looks ugly, I would say, but it does look too chaotic and a little naive, and they're sort of sucked into this vortex of despair, and it's Also, I think they don't have 90 minutes in them at the moment, Liverpool. So there have been elements in the last two performances, maybe the last three, where there's been a bit of legginess, a bit of treacle running, and they've shaken that off for a finale. But that's not how to run a football campaign when you're in with the title. I don't know, Tom. I think it's probably an inevitable consequence of the way Liverpool do play that it will at times drift into chaos. I think they can get it back, though. I don't feel like this is the end of this particular style, and it's run its course and it's to be laughed at. I think it'll come good when they win 4-0 in the Europa League.
Excellent. You think it can come back, and we will come back to that point. Tony Cascarino, on the idea of missed chances, 2.87 Liverpool's expected goals in this match, their most on record since 2010-11 in a Premier League match in which they did not score. Obviously, the weekend before, Manchester United, lots and lots of chances again. At some point for a top-level player, does it become a bit more in your head of like, God, we're not taking all these chances? Because some of them, they were sitters. Yeah. I was in the office yesterday, and it was one of those ones where everyone says in unison, oh my God, how did he not score? And yes, as Greg said, Palace were wonderful, lots of great blocks. But is there anything getting into the mentality of Liverpool players at the minute?
Well, I've been fortunate in my career to play with some very great forwards, from Frank Stapleton to John Aldridge, Clive Allen, Teddy Sheringham, Dwight York, and having a bit of guile in front of goal. And I've mentioned to him before, Nunes, as good as he can be with his run, his attitude and everything else, when he blasts from 2 yards out and somehow keeps... It's like the kids playing football match and the dad joins in and he blasts the ball into the kid's face from like 5 yards nearly every time. I'm like, can he not just have a little bit of guile in front of goal? I mean, I ain't as gifted as him, but I'm sure I could maybe try and pick a spot. He doesn't never want to pick a spot, does he? If you think of the two goals at Newcastle away, where two incredible finishes, bottom corner, you know, in the game, I think they're classy finishes. But so often he opts for the just, I'll smash it as hard as I can. And yes, it might break the net like Alan Shearer did on a regular basis. But there's never any guile in any of his finishes for me. Mm. And Salah's been poor. Salah should have been dropped. Anyone who's telling me otherwise, they ain't watching Liverpool every week. Salah's had a really poor period. His game at Old Trafford last week, where he scored from the penalty spot, he wasn't playing well again. And I was like, is there a time where you... As a manager, you're in your final run-in and you've got to make a massive call and you're going to get ridiculed if it goes wrong. But Harvey Elliott's offered way more than Salah when he's been playing in recent games. I wasn't surprised they got beat by Atlanta. Of course, I was surprised by the 3-0 defeat. I've been saying for a long time, Tom, it's coming, that type of performance, because Liverpool are giving away so many chances. And the forwards... I'm now missing more often. Jota's been a big miss. Mm. He's been a big miss because he is a really good finisher. And he, you know, I had a guy I was working on there yesterday, and I worked with Natalie Sawyer. She's a Brentford fan. And I blamed her because Brentford was the game he got injured. They kicked him and he had that, you know, saying it's your fault. Jota's missing, you know, blaming Natalie.
Here we go. We're off, listeners.
So it's been a really hard watch with Liverpool. I don't believe they can get it back. I really don't.
Why do you think that?
They've got 4 away games in the last 6 games. I do not see Liverpool getting maximum points at all with away games.
Let's come back to that because I want to bring it all back. Let's bring in Arsenal. Let's talk about this in a big kind of rounded way like we've planned it, which we haven't. So to the Emirates and Alison Rudd, having watched your beloved Liverpool drop points, you then went and watched Arsenal drop points. You were there reporting for us. Without getting into Aston Villa, we're very good because we're going to talk about fourth place and them and Tottenham in the second half of the show. Just Arsenal. What was it about this Arsenal performance that felt for you like, they're not quite there. They're not quite going to make it.
Well, they were good in the first half. I would agree with Arteta that they were good.
Missed big chances as well, like Liverpool.
There was a sort of really naff header into the side netting from Jesus.
Trossard.
Saka. There were some really good chances, but I know I'm not allowed to talk about Villa, but some good defending. There were parallels with the Crystal Palace Anfield.
You can mention them. I'm just making enough, sure Villa fans know that we are going to give them plenty of love in the second half.
But there was in that first half there was a determined effort to defend in numbers and be very concentrated. And that's what, and they executed it well, and Arsenal couldn't find a way through. But they were doing, I think they were playing with confidence. I mean, everyone would have been looking at that game after the Liverpool result and thinking, aha, you know, is this, how's this going to affect Arsenal? Will they feel like that sort of extra pressure not to, to muck things up because now it looked like everything was going really well for them? Or would they find the pressure too great that they were expected to take advantage of a blip in Liverpool's challenge for the top? And that first half, there was no sense at all that they were emotionally struggling. They were calm. They played measured football. They did what they normally do, which is you've got Ødegaard pulling the strings, and they just looked very grown up. But the factors in the second half in particular were there was a sudden tiredness, which could have been both mental and physical. And Ødegaard got kicked in the chest from an overhead kick, and he stayed on for a bit and then he went off. But his levels dipped, and then he wasn't actually there, and that's when the goals were scored against them. A jitteriness came into them, so just almost like a flick of a switch. As soon as Ødegaard wasn't there for everybody with that aura he has, it all became a little bit jittery and a little bit it's like dominoes, you know, tick 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 tick. Then little mistakes became slightly bigger mistakes, and Villa were waiting for that moment. It came, and suddenly they were playing expansive, confident football, and that really shook Arsenal. So I don't think you can say, Arsenal, it's history repeating itself. Arsenal can't cope with the pressure of being favourites in the title race. It was more minute than that. It was more about the way that game developed. I don't think it necessarily means anything for the next match.
Interesting. And again, we will come back to that theme. Thank you so much for teeing me up for this final section of part one. But you mentioned some really interesting points there, because I was watching the game in the office, and I was watching it in relation to Ødegaard and maybe Saka as well. And Tony, I'm going to come to you on this, because you mentioned players like Salah for Liverpool. And I was watching this game and thinking back to great teams who've won the Premier League title. Manchester United's, when they had either Cristiano Ronaldo, or back when I first started watching football, Eric Cantona, that season where he came back and I think they won like 5 games 1-0. And I always remember watching on Match of the Day a match where they beat Tottenham 1-0 and he just picked the ball up on the halfway line, beat 3 players and scored. Cristiano Ronaldo did it. Didier Drogba used to do it for Chelsea. Aguero did it for City. I was watching this and thinking, this is a match where if Arsenal had an absolute worldy player, you know, and I'm not saying they've not got absolutely brilliant players, and players like Trossard and Havertz have been superb in recent matches, but when you're playing a very good team against Aston Villa, you need maybe a Kevin De Bruyne to pick up the ball, beat 2 men and bang one in the top corner for a 1-0 win. Is this a sign that Arsenal are still just not quite at that level yet?
Well, you mentioned great players and names, and most of them would be centre-forwards as well within that, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
And Gabriel Jesus has got 1 goal in the Premier League since the new year, you know. And yes, he's been injured this summer. They brought him in to do a job of lifting the club, you know, being a winner elsewhere. He's versatile in the way he plays. I think it was a moment for me. They don't really have that type of forward. They all have qualities, but different ones. Most natural finisher for me out of all of the Arsenal forwards is Nketiah. But he's not made the team. He's out the side. It's really hard because Arsenal have got goals from many areas. Martinelli on the bench yesterday, and Trossard can get goals, so can Saka get goals. Havertz can chip in. It was a really hard watch because I have to mention Arsenal. I thought the game in midweek was a big telling point because Harry Kane played a role where he was dropping off the Saliba and Gabriel, and they were getting free runners, all going at Arsenal's back four. The Bayern team. And that's been a struggling Bayern team. And yesterday, when Bailey came on, there was a runner now behind the back line. And I felt it was more about that problem. And Arsenal did something a few years ago, and I always remember the game, was Monaco at home in the Champions League. They were 2-0 down, and they got back to 2-1 at the Emirates. and the whole team literally grabbed, well, one player, I think it was Giroud, grabbed the ball, ran the halfway line, sprint back, put it on, there's like 3 minutes left, and I'm thinking, 2-1, you can win in Monaco, you can win there, you know, don't lose this game 3-1. And they ended up losing it 3-1, and it was a, it reminded me of the second half yesterday, where it became all hot round the collar, and everyone, the desperation to win, and maybe a draw.
Take the 0-0.
Well, just don't get beat. And Gary Neville mentioned it in commentary. And of course, they went to Monaco. They won 2-0 and went out on their away goals. Mm. And I remember thinking that at that time of that, not getting caught up in the moment. And I thought Arsenal definitely got caught up in the moment in the second half.
Yeah, I think you know, Alison was there and she would have, you know, grasped what the atmosphere felt like and stuff. It did feel watching this game that the pressure, you know, we visibly grew as the game progressed, though. And that affected their play. They felt that it was more kind of stodgy. And look, although we're going to come and talk about Villa, they played the game brilliantly, and they opened the game up, and it became much more stretched. And but I don't think you can really. I don't think it's fair, actually. After, you know, we've gone on a roller coaster with Arsenal about not having a striker, and then they find, as Tony's saying, they're finding goals from all over the pitch, and it's about the way they set up the team to continually create chances, and they're always creating more chances than the opposition, and they created chances in this game. They just didn't put them away. I don't think it's fair just to say that they need, where's the match winner, the one kind of match winner. They have players who've been match winners, but more than anything, they've been the most sort of highly functioning team in the league this season, and like with exhibited the most control in most games. In this game, the pressure grew. And because they hadn't taken the lead, they'd missed those chances in the first half, it grew more and more. And I just think that ultimately, Villa sucker punched them. They're a very good team.
Quickly, to Tony's point about the defence then, and Saliba and Gabriel, both in that Bayern match and then this match, because that's been a huge part of their season. That's the reason why in that show that never existed, you started to come round to the idea that Arsenal...
Not true, Tom. Not true.
He definitely said it, listeners. He did.
Not true.
He did. But what Prove do you it. Make of that point about... what do you make of that point about Arsenal's defence just showing slight signs? Is it tiredness? Is it fatigue at this stage in the season?
I mean, look, we saw signs of... Again, but there were fine margins against Bayern. And, you know, with Sané running at ridiculous speed for the first goal... A very small error for the second that was punished. In this game, was there really a kind of considerable a big error for that first goal? The second one was on the break. You know, it was Declan Rice was ended up being the man who was marking Bailey at the back post, and he wasn't really marking him. And like no one could cut the ball out across the box. It was. I don't think their defence has been any worse, really. I think that they've played against two really good teams, and in this game, as I say, the second half. The pressure grew, the kind of desperation grew as well. And we're going to talk about Villa. Villa played the game brilliantly.
We will talk about Villa, I promise, but I'm going to bring it back now to the title race because Manchester City sit top of the table after that very comfortable win against Luton. The perfect weekend for Pep Guardiola. Rested some of his star players, some of his squad players come in and get goals. Yes, Tony, I might have made it the cover of the game with a picture of Pep Guardiola smoking a cigar. That's just the kind of funny guy I am. But... Martin Samuel, with an immediate riposte for my jesting on the Times website right now. Put the cigars away! Manchester City haven't won the title yet. Don't be fooled by this weekend's slip-up. City can still wobble while Liverpool and Arsenal are far from out of it. So don't look away. Not just yet. And Alison, so I'll come back to you because you've made this point with Liverpool and slightly with Arsenal. It sounds like you believe that this is still the three-team title race that we all hope it is.
Of course it is. I mean, I agree with Martin. It'd be madness to just all pack up our TV sets and our season tickets and not bother. I mean, recent history shows that of all the teams that can cope with the run-in and the pressure and having lots and lots of matches all piling up, it's Guardiola. I mean, they did win the treble last season, for goodness sake, and he's spent most of this season moaning about how many... fixtures, and it could be, you know, 3 days off, back again, 3 days off, back again, if he stays in all the competitions. And he likes to moan about it. It's weird, it's ironic he moans about
it. Subtle dig alert,
he's the one that that copes the best with it.
Jürgen never moaned. Never moaned, old Jürgen. No.
I've never heard him moan.
No, never. Tony, you were saying, however, in your column and in your assessment of Liverpool, in your column, the lead item, chaotic and wasteful Liverpool do not deserve to win the title. Does that mean you don't think that they will now?
No, I don't. I don't think they'll win it. I think I've seen every game this year, largely. And I've come away thinking there was a number of games, even if you want to go Sheffield United at Anfield, where it was 1-1, it was tight, Liverpool get over the line, Forest away, Liverpool get over the line, the game away at Crystal Palace, where Liverpool made two substitutions late in the game.
Fulham at home.
Yeah, Fulham at home. There's been a huge amount of games where Liverpool have conceded loads of chances.
What was it, 27 points from losing possessions?
Yeah, there are a huge amount of points. You could look at it two ways and go, yeah, it's brilliant, the character of the team is not questioned, which I don't. I think it was a tough week. I thought Atalanta were a real difficult opponent midweek because their energy was extraordinary. And that they got run into the ground, which they've done so often to others. I just don't see it.
What about Arsenal then?
Well, I think Arsenal are more in a better a chance of finishing or winning the league than Liverpool. I think Liverpool will finish third. I did mention earlier they got 4 away games to 2 home games left. I don't see them picking up even close to maximum points. I think they play Villa. I might even make an argument that Villa might finish in front of Liverpool. How about that one? Okay.
I'm glad we got the cheerful things out the way early. Bloody hell.
So when they go to Villa Park and if Villa beat them, it don't make them too bad off from where Liverpool are. Because I ain't convinced Liverpool are going to get a huge amount of points.
They'll still be 5 points ahead of them, Tom.
Okay. Right.
Anyway,
the thing is, this week is going to be huge because if Liverpool go out of Europe, if Arsenal go out of Europe, then it's even more of a test.
And if City stay in Europe, with them huge match against Real Madrid.
City of all the teams are in the driving seat in Europe too. So if at the end of this week, City are sitting atop of the league, they're into the Champions League semi, and the other two are out. That's a psychological massive boost for them.
Right, do you remember when Liverpool beat Crystal Palace 7-0 at Selhurst Park? Mm. You know, after that game, they lost their next 6 home games. When they fell away, they went to the floor, Liverpool. And it was all the pandemic and, not having crowds, it affected them. Liverpool literally went to the wall. It was unbelievable. And I'm not confident Liverpool winning anywhere at the moment. I look at them and I think, yeah, they can score loads of goals. I know they can. They've always got goals. Their ratio tells you goals expected. Well, what about goals against expected? Because they can concede so many chances. I just don't know how people can think they can win these games.
Klopp looked grey.
Yes.
After this game, it looked like he did not know.
A lot of the players
look grey as well. He did not have a clue what has happened to his team in the last week.
But this is another thing, and I know, Gregory, I take your point about my assessment of Arsenal and star players, but we've made a huge point about Virgil van Dijk being superb all season. Tony, you're criticising Mo Salah. Again, that midfield again for Liverpool, I just thought was lacking. And whilst we've praised it so much and Paul Joyce has written, they made very astute signings, which they did. But then in crunch time, they just all dip a little bit. And for 2 games now, it felt like they've not had a midfield, Liverpool, against Manchester United and Crystal Palace, where perhaps you should have a little bit more control.
Gregor mentioned Eze. Eze must have thought, I love this. I mean, one player in the Premier League you don't want to give 2 or 3 yards to in front of Liverpool's 18-yard box is him.
Yeah, but just coming back to Manchester City, who obviously we're not analysing in great detail because they had a nice, easy win. But in Martin Samuel's column, there's a paragraph which is interesting to remind us of because as much as they were superb and cruised to the title, he says, in other seasons, however, there were spills. Leads were established and rivals stumbled, which is why City came out on top. In 2022, City dropped 2 points in the penultimate game away to West Ham and needed a staggering comeback on the last day against Aston Villa to deny Liverpool. In 2021, City's winning run was interrupted by defeats to Leeds and Chelsea. And in 2018, a home defeat against Manchester United was sandwiched between 2 Champions League reverses to Liverpool. It didn't matter because City were already in the clear and had the title wrapped up. Yet this title race isn't like that one. There's scant margin for error. And as much as we're criticising these 2 teams now, we have also been saying City are not...
You've got to put it in context. Yeah. We always have to put it in context. Yeah. We're forgetting, this is a... Look, there are so many caveats about this team, but they are the best team that the Premier League has ever seen. They are. And who knows how history will reflect on this Manchester City team and football club as a whole. But they're the best team that the Premier League has ever seen. The numbers prove it, really. And so does the eye.
So
that's always the context. No one is a bottler. Arsenal haven't bottled it. Liverpool haven't bottled it. The standards that they have to meet now are unprecedented.
But are you title races on or title races over?
It's on.
Yes, there he is. Chirpy Gregor Robertson's here.
It's on, but again, we have seen, as Alison said, that City are the team who have always come out of these battles. Ultimately, some of the statistics Martin's kind of alluding to there, I think you're clutching a little bit because some of them they were out in front, and even the ones where they did drop points, they still found a way, they still made the comeback.
I'll let you tell him that on Thursday.
have you looked at the City's remaining Premier League games?
Yes, I have, Tony. Okay. Would you like me to read them?
Yeah, read them out, and you tell me where they're going to drop points.
Brighton away, tricky game, that could be.
What, the Brighton of the start of the season? Absolutely not.
Yeah, Roberto De Zerbi determined to prove a point that he deserves to be a Liverpool manager. Nottingham Forest fighting for their lives away from home.
Yeah, they'll stuff City, they will.
Wolves, you love Wolves. You absolutely love Wolves. Your mate Gary O'Neill. Fulham, we all love Fulham. Brilliant team away from home. That'll be tough. And then Tottenham, complete chaos. Who knows what's going to happen with them?
Yeah, they play. They're going to lose every game. Yeah, good luck.
They're going to get overtaken by Aston Villa. Never mind Liverpool. So right, I'm 3-team title race. Alison Rudd, 3-team title race. Gregor Robertson, 3-team title race. Yeah. Antonio Cascarino, just a 2-team title race because you're so sad about Liverpool. There you go, Game Podcast listeners. Nice and enthusiastic on a Monday. If you think the title race is over, or maybe you think maybe Liverpool might still win it, and you think Tony Cascarino's wrong, get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. But for now, Aston Villa fans, thank you for sticking with us. We're talking about you next.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Tony Cascarino, Alison Rudd, and Gregor Robertson. Now we're going to go back to the Emirates. I promised you, I wasn't lying to you, Aston Villa fans. How great were Unai Emery's side? Who wants to go first? Gregor, I can tell. No, Alison Rudd, she's put her hand up and everything. It's like being back at school. Alison Rudd, tell us all about Aston Villa.
I was first.
No shouting, Tony.
Impressed. That's why I want to say something, because I was so impressed with Villa. So when you're in it's quite a low press box at the Emirates, and I was directly behind Unai Emery, who never stopped. I mean, I was a bit worried about his pants because he leans forward so a lot and he wears quite tight pants. I thought they might.
Thought it might be a rip in the
cards. Might be a rip, but there wasn't. I managed to keep my eyes away from that.
Keep your eyes out for that in the coming weeks. He's got some big games coming up.
Exactly. But he never stopped just gesticulating, shouting, pointing. He was the amount of energy he expended and emanated to the team, and from what I could gather, I mean, they seemed to respond and do as they were told, because it was I think I used the word masterclass in my piece. It was a masterclass, and you could frame the whole thing as he's going back to the place where he more or less failed. He certainly didn't succeed as Arsenal manager, but he's gone back with his reputation enhanced, and boy, oh boy, did he show that. I felt that it was a defensive masterclass in the first half. Very, very, very concerted, concentrated, very grown-up defending. Not didn't put a foot wrong. One or two great saves, but that's part of it, isn't it, having a goalkeeper you trust? And then in the second half, I mean, he claimed not to have said too much at halftime. I don't actually believe him, because in the second half they were almost sort of sticking their tongue out at Arsenal a bit, because they started to pass it around at the back. They were really oozing confidence. It was like they were taunting them and saying, yes, you didn't score in the first half, did you? And this is something we might now do. They were passing it around at the back, taking risks, but without any jitteriness at all. They moved the ball up the pitch a bit more quickly. They were expansive. They used the lines. They were just so confident. And Tielemans, I gave him man of the match in that I gave him the highest mark. I think I gave him 9 out of 10.
You did?
Quite a high mark. Because
that shot.
As you know, I'm a big fan of Ødegaard. He almost put Ødegaard in the shade in terms of just consistently intelligent balls, inventive passing. He could have scored himself. His delivery from set pieces was good, and his pass to Ollie Watkins was, you know, people use the phrase beautifully weighted, but I mean it really, really was, and the vision for that as well. So it was like he was in control of the match. There was Arsenal trying to take advantage of Liverpool dropping points. It's all about Arsenal and the title race, superior Arsenal. And yet your eyes were on him, how he orchestrated it, and how they grew through the game from a very, very solid base. I think masterclass is an overused term, but I think it was in this case.
Did it feel like, just to Tony's point that you mentioned in the part one about Leon Bailey coming on after an hour, did that feel like a deliberately targeted move? Like, we've kind of stayed in this game half an hour now. Let's bring a player on who's going to run in behind. Did that feel like a deliberate move, or was it just a straight swap with Diaby?
No, it felt planned, in that you could see that Arsenal were tiring, and he's an excellent player to bring on in that circumstance. So I didn't feel it was, you know, on the hoof. I felt it was like, yeah, let's stretch it, tire them out, go for it.
I was at the Brentford game last week, and they were shambolic defensively. And I have to be brutally honest, and I look at...
You are prepared to mention that you said on Monday's show, are you?
I look at their back four, and I'm not overly convinced about them individually. Defensively, Digne, no. Mm-hmm. Not a great defender as left-back. Pau Torres is outstanding on the ball. Great kind of coming out with it and playing kind of line-splitting passes, really incisive passes, great left foot. Defensively, slightly suspect, I think, particularly when they're to play the high line. Carlos, he was brilliant in this game.
He was,
but he's,
yeah.
You know, he's had some injury troubles. He's not always been convincing. He certainly wasn't against Brentford. And Concert, right back, has done well, but he's had moments where he's also not been convincing. But in this game, they were so well organised, so compact. And they also didn't have Douglas Luiz in front of them. And Tielemans, he's been so useful for them this season. He's often played as the man off the front, off the striker. It's like the number 10. He sometimes played kind of wide and drifting into little pockets of space. But he's also really good at just being the kind of holding midfielder,
yep,
and dictating play. And the same's true with John McGinn. They've got so much kind of flexibility with their midfielders. And they also lost Boubacar Kamara. So people have had to fill in those different roles. And I think it just speaks to Emery's coaching and the sort of flexibility of their play. They can play like this. They can be the dominant force as well on the ball, and they can switch it, and they can be brilliant on the counter-attack. Yeah. They're the most flexible team kind of tactically, I think, in the league.
So we've had Unai Emery, we've had the defence, and now we come to the founder, chairman, president and club secretary of the Ollie Watkins fan club, Tony Cascarino. Take it away.
just...
I told you.
I told you because Ollie Watkins is a player that I saw at Exeter under Paul Tisdale. I think you was with me on that trip, Al, weren't you? Was it Paul Tisdale we went down there?
I was with you, yes.
Yeah, Paul Tisdale.
Nice little trip.
Ollie Watkins trip down was to there the sea. At that time. Yeah. He was playing there as a winger. And I remember watching him and thinking, you can see there's a player, you know, any player that's quick, you notice straight away. And then there's the energy and the selfless way of playing, and he's done all of that. And as he's progressed, there's always been a question mark of where he stands. Is it behind Harry Kane? Is it Ivan Toney in front of him? Is Solanke better than him? And I'm thinking, unless I'm wrong, I've watched a player week by week, all over the season, especially in open play, get goals for fun and absolutely be the reason why Villa are in the top four at the moment. There are other qualities there. And I agree with Gregor what he was saying defensively. You could put a number of asterisks over some of them because they have. Do you know what one? And I was thinking about this game from an Emery perspective where he was let go by Arsenal, not deemed good enough, and he's ended up beating Arsenal home and away. Mm. Right? And they went in front 1-0 early on at Villa Park after about 7 minutes with John McGinn, and eventually it was done in a different way this weekend. But it was some he'd spotted Zinchenko was there for the taking. Mm. He'd spotted it. And he's probably gone, do you know what? There's going to be a period of a game where I'm going to put Bailey on and he's going to get behind that position. Because down the right, in the latter stages of the game, Villa were coming regularly, coming down that right side.
The Watkins goal was that side as well, wasn't
it? Yeah. And look, Konsa is an interesting player because I thought he played really well yesterday. He was up against Trossard and he was up against Martinelli. And he sort of had them both their number in the game. But also, would you make a point that I was thinking Arsenal have had four goalkeepers. You can go Leno, under Arteta, Leno, Raya, obviously Ramsdale and Martinez. And I was thinking, out of them goalkeepers, Martinez the best one. And he's the one that's gone to Villa Park.
The best shot stopper.
Best goalkeeper. I think he's the most complete out of them four.
Right.
Have you said to me out of the four, who's got the most about... And there's something about Martinez that's odd. It feels like...
He had to leave to really discover that. Yes. For everyone else.
Well, he was obviously told, Gregor, he's not going to be number one at Arsenal.
No.
Okay, he's obviously...
Sometimes that happens.
And that happens in football. You make a call. And by the way, it's not really a manager's call. Nine times out of ten, it's the goalkeeping coach's call. Because managers go to their goalkeeping coach and they ask about, come on, what do you think? And they'll go, this one is a better keeper for certain reasons, the way we want to play, blah, blah, blah. But I thought that Watkins' performance just justified everything he's done this season.
Mm.
And I was making an argument. If I was Gareth Southgate, I wouldn't ignore playing him and Kane together.
Yeah.
I really wouldn't, for something very different, because there's 50 goals there.
Yeah.
And whether people think, no, you can't do that, I tell you what, I wouldn't mind seeing it, because Kane can drop in and Watkins can go on the other side.
The thing you've seen of him this season, though, is he's got a swagger now.
Mm. That finish.
Yeah, and then he runs over to him and he's like that. He's pointing to the floor going, I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm here. And that, you didn't see that from him, like, even last season. And this season he's kind of... it's not a cockiness, but like a total belief that he is like the main man, and that he said in his interview after the game last week, you know, this we didn't kind of produce a big team performance, big team mentality. We didn't have that big team mentality. He's calling out his team. He said, I'm part of that, but he was calling out his teammates. So as I say, he's grown in stature and he really is the kind of talisman for them.
Yeah, I think it's probably that goal and that moment that slightly influenced my thinking about Arsenal players and big game players. These players that get that chance, run through, little dink, run to the corner, here I am, the big I am. The other thing that happened in the office, as well as everyone shouting about Liverpool, how they missed, was that as soon as Ollie Watkins scored that goal, I think three people went, get him on the plane! Get him on the plane! So just checking we're all in agreement. Tony wants him to start. And we're having this debate about Ivan Toney or Ollie Watkins. Does it even matter? Ollie Watkins?
They might take them both.
We should take them both. Of course.
Alison?
Yeah. Play to your strengths. I like what Tony was saying about Martinez. We always forget how important keepers are. Unless there's a manager who's like swapping in and swapping out, we don't really discuss them. And I agree, Watkins is a talisman, but the personality of Villa is through Martinez. He does all the dirty stuff. He time wastes.
Yeah.
He looks at the opposition fans. He plays the clown. He winds people up.
Did he
gives them that little bit of edge that they might not have without him.
Yes, and John McGinn Gregor yesterday.
I whispered that, but
sneak that in. Yeah. Well, Villa's win took them back into fourth, 3 points clear of Tottenham, though Tottenham have a game in hand. The reason they are 3 points clear of Tottenham is after an absolute stinker for Ange Postecoglou's side. 4-0 defeat against Newcastle. Has this been coming, Gregor? Come on, Mr. Ange. Tony's the founder, president, club secretary of the Ollie Watkins fan club. I go to you as the Ange Postecoglou founder, president and club secretary. It's looking not great after this performance.
No, I mean, this was... I think, as he said, it's going to have a lot of self-inflicted damage. Pedro Porro's, like, bizarre kind of hook back towards his own goal. Van Ven slipping for the first one, I think it was. And then, you know... Tony's written about in his column today, you want to see, you know, a streak of pragmatism or a kind of a slight, you know, when things are going wrong, show some sort of aptitude or like desire to correct it. And that's what they didn't do. But there's no point in you're just shouting at the sky when you're seeing this with Ange Postecoglou, because this is the way he plays. And yeah, they did the way that Romero and Van Ven dealt with, Isak. Or just one didn't cover, essentially. Mm. I know they're trying to play a high line, they're trying to catch him offside a lot, but there were several occasions where they were really sloppy with that. But I don't think we're going to see Spurs change. And I think you've got to give real credit to Newcastle as well in this, because it was a clear tactic from the off. It was like, we're going to spring this line and we've got somebody with the pace of Isak and, you know, who could finish as clinically as him, who can exploit it. And there were several occasions where it kind of almost came off as well, but he was outstanding. He's one of the best strikers in the Premier League.
Mm-hmm. And Postecoglou said after the game, "There's another game coming. You've just got to get ready for that. It's not the first time it's happened to us, and it won't be the last. It is part of our growth. Sometimes that growth is painful." Thinking about Alisson, your point about Liverpool and sometimes that chaos is not beautiful earlier. This growth is painful. In terms of this idea of this podcast, where are we all getting carried away? It's all over. Let's make big outlandish statements. Are Tottenham still in this race for fourth, or is this a slightly worrying sign with the games that they've got to come, which include Arsenal, Liverpool, and Manchester City?
No, their run-in means they won't finish top four. But the really interesting part of this, which answers your point, is that afterwards, James Maddison said it was because the result happened because Spurs were not brave enough. They weren't Ange enough. They weren't. It looks like, they were caught out because they're too open, and they can be exploited by being too open. But Maddison wasn't saying, "Oh, we could have been tighter, or we could have been more intelligent." He was saying we should have doubled down on our Postecoglou-ness, which is, I think, that means you're never ever going to, if that's what one of your key players says to the media, you are never going to see Postecoglou have a plan B that you want to see him have. All you'll have is plan A, and plan A hyped up.
Well, it wasn't necessarily just an idea of saying, oh, plan B, and that's quite lazy for me to think like that, because I was trying to make the point that sometimes you have to adapt to the opposition. You know, if you go in the boxing ring and you're facing a big puncher and you go, do you know what? I'll try and out-punch him. And you're not a puncher. To play the offside against not one quick forward, Gregor, it's three. Gordon's very, really quick, and so is Barnes. All three of them are quick. And when you're trying to play offside, by the way, and the opposition's half, where he can't be offside, how can Van der Ven be in front of the halfway line? You're not. He's onside because he's in his own half, Isak. I understand that logic at all, because to me, there's a high line, get that. But surely, if you've got quick forwards, you must think of going 2 or 3 yards, give yourself a bit more of a chance to get in behind. I understand where he wants to play, but to me, you have to be adaptable to some level, because let's get this right. Tottenham went to Villa Park and won 4-0, right? Villa played two up front, and then it played right into Tottenham's hand. They played really well on the day. They won 4-0. How, you know, and I have to always remind myself, don't overreact to one particular game, because, you know, the Tottenham 4-0 victory at Villa Park was extraordinary.
It wasn't a 4-0, no.
No, it wasn't a 4-0, but that was the final score. But to see Tottenham then get done, I thought Tottenham could go to Newcastle and win. But I didn't think they would gamble as much as they did on the high line against three quick forwards. That to me was ultimately the difference. It's okay maybe we won, but you've got three. Gordon was loving it. Anthony Gordon was loving his chance just to get behind Ndoggy, or you know, just get, you know, behind the team. And
love it.
But what should they have done? Because Madison's saying they should have done more of it, not less of it.
If you think about what they're, if you say they're not being brave enough, when they turn over the ball, that's when they're facing the biggest threat. So I think what he's saying is they've got to be braver on the ball. It's not necessarily being braver and, you know, pushing up. Although having said that, there wasn't much protection in front of them. Often the best. The thing that's so striking about watching Spurs is just how high they support the kind of the press. So like every midfielder, even sometimes Romero, they're just pushing in to win as soon as the ball turns over, they win it back again. So that was off kilter. A lot of the time where the ball was turned over, a Newcastle player had the opportunity to look up and play the ball.
Exactly,
behind.
That's the problem. If any player with any ability, technical, if you can't get on him and stop him playing that pass with his head up, you're in trouble. It doesn't matter who you're playing against, because I understand what Madison is saying, as in we probably get higher up in the pitch in forward areas, but I'm still bothered by this, how this high line can be actually on the halfway line. That to me, Villa dropped a bit.
Sometimes it's higher than the halfway line.
The halfway high line sounds a little bit like a kind of country album from a couple of years ago.
No.
This is Tony Cascarino and the halfway
Villa,
high line.
Villa play a high line, but they wasn't as high as they normally are. Mm. Villa have been way higher in certain games.
They did get Arsenal offside a lot as well, I kept noticing. So there's a high line that works and a high line that doesn't work.
That's ultimately the crux of it. Yeah. It's like, Ange will just think, we need to do what we do better.
Yeah, which is kind of what he's saying. But in terms of doing what he does better, Alison, you've kind of given your verdict, Aston Villa finishing fourth for you, just to confirm. Tony, Villa fourth?
Do you need to ask me that question?
Well, I'm just, you know, I thought for the sake of it, well, you can just nod if you want. Villa nodding, won't finish. Nodding.
Villa won't finish fourth, they'll be third.
Yeah.
Oh.
He's gone back on, he's doubling down modern politics for the year there. Gregor, any hope for Tottenham?
Yeah, absolutely. They've still got a game in hand. And obviously their goal difference has been shot a bit with this one, but it's just like the Premier League, the title race. There's still a race for fourth.
Absolutely. It would be very Tottenham and Ange Postecoglou to beat all three of those teams in the title race and finish. Maybe they'll finish third. Who knows? Newcastle, then, we've touched on them very slightly. In six at the minute, 50 points. They've had a very strange season. Highs of the Champions League. Then lots of questions about, has it all gone wrong? They're conceding much more goals than they were last season. With players like Barnes coming back, and as Tony, you said, with this front three, that's a pretty good front three. Most teams would be very happy with that. Are they going to hopefully cruise to a finish of this season, maybe finish six, and Eddie Howe will go, great. Mm. It's not progress in the sense of we finished higher than we did last season, but it's progress in the big building job that he's doing.
Some clubs, Tom, have had an injury list that's been devastating. I put Newcastle in that bracket. You know, you think that Pope has been out for a large part of the season, then you go from Trippier to Botman, and others. They've had a huge injury list. Littington's been out for a while. Callum Wilson, likewise.
Lascelles just in his ACL.
I mean, you just go through the team and you'll find that Newcastle have had it pretty bad. But when they've got that front three, and I've always been a fan. I watched a lot of Harvey Barnes at West Brom. I remember thinking there's a real player in there. He's quite direct. He's not.
He'd be good for Spurs.
He loves to cut inside, doesn't he, Gregor? He loves to cut in and come in on his right foot. And if he's fit, and Gordon's now seems to have grown up since he left Everton and joined Newcastle and got his backside smacked a little bit because of his behaviour, he seems to feel. And he didn't mind playing out on the right.
Yeah.
Because his position is more obvious,
Barnes
is the left.
Yeah.
But he didn't mind playing there. He actually enjoyed it. And Isak is a big one. They're going to have to, as we've said, Newcastle have to keep him.
Mm.
And I think there'll be a lot of vultures hanging around Isak this
Arsenal?
Summer.
Good enough?
Well, whoever. Is he
good enough for a top
three
title?
I think Man United should be going after him. I think he's that type of player. He reminds me of, you know, the way he finishes. I mean, he's very Henri-like.
His finishing is brilliant.
Yeah.
He opens up. You're right. Yeah. He opens up a lot of the time and strokes it in with inside his foot, but with power. Yeah. Eddie Howe kind of summed up brilliantly, I think, after this game. He was like, this is just a reminder that we can compete with the best teams and we can also be a really obdurate, difficult team to play against. Like, I think he was just delighted to see the team he knows he has, a kind of recognisable team back once again.
Absolutely. Well, we come on to the final point of the show, the Sunday question. As an editor editing the game and football pages as I was, and you get the call from the reporter who's been at the Manchester United game with the dreaded question, does it have to be about Manchester United? And yes, Gregor Robertson, I think it does. 2-2 against Bournemouth. As much as we'd love to say Andoni Iraola, what a wonderful guy. What a great performance. Manchester United, again, saved by VAR. Loads of chaos. Alejandro Garnacho, been brilliant, but now he's in trouble as well. What have you got to tell us? Tell the listener something interesting about Manchester United, Gregor.
I said in my piece, there was like, in the first 10 minutes, there were like a handful of occasions where the body language of United's players was absolutely miserable. It was extraordinary. And you see it more in the flesh. Like, I've not seen them in the flesh for a little while. Watched their games on TV and stuff. But, I mean, Fernandes was waving his arms around, like, remonstrating with Onana for who was trying to play it short and saying... And then Ten Hag was on the touchline saying, like, with his hands out, saying, calm down, calm down, calm down. He was arguing with the manager. This is within the first 5 minutes. Onana played a ball in behind Rashford that Rashford just didn't chase, and he just stood there staring at Onana, like, as if to say, what the hell was that? Casemiro, like, just looked affronted if he had to break into a jog. It was extraordinary. All of them. Garnacho was just like, in fairness... It was his 30th consecutive start. I think he trained once this week. He was obviously not right, but he was miles off it as well. They were just like, from the off, you were just thinking. And then there were so many things where it was like, it's just so predictable now. You know, they went behind. They were shocking in the first half. Then it got to 2-1, and everyone in the press box was like, well, you know, this is going to be a 2-2. They'll nick a draw again. And I heard someone in the concourse going, at half-time, going... And then Erik ten Hag will come out afterwards and say, we deserve to win that game. It's just like they're a joke. It's like everyone knows what's coming. And in fairness, you know, that's how I start my piece. Ten Hag did not for once speak as though he'd been watching a different game. He said, we didn't deserve anything more than this today.
Did he feel like a man in the press conference, even increasingly aware that his job is maybe not
going to be his? The last question he was asked was, put him, he was kind of just about to get up, and somebody said, you're in danger of if you finish below seventh, it's the worst finish in Manchester United's Premier League history. And he kind of got up and left and said, I'm not answering that, it's not I think he said it's not relevant yet or something like that. People then reported that he stormed out. He didn't storm out, but it was like he didn't appreciate being asked that question either. I don't know if it feels like he knows his time's coming to an end, but I think everyone else does.
That's always the uncomfortable thing with a Manchester United manager, isn't it? Louis van Gaal was the same. He was like, great, I've won the FA Cup.
But Louis van Gaal, as much as you talk, you could debate his kind of the merits of his approach and, you know, Manchester United passing the ball around and boring everyone to death, at least you saw some evidence of what his strategy was. We're 2 years into Ten Hag's and we don't see any evidence of strategy. And as I said in this piece, they've just played in the last couple of months, as well as Liverpool, City and Chelsea. I park them to one side because they're teams who in theory are, you know, have the same ambitions as United. They've played Fulham, Brentford and Bournemouth, and Marco Silva, Thomas Frank and Andoni Iraola have comprehensively outthought, and their teams have looked better coached than Manchester United, and that's damning.
Well, that is going to lead me on to the final segment, which I'm just making up off the top of my head, because looking at the Premier League table, I realise this podcast has been incredibly elitist. We've just slowly crawled down the Premier League table until we've hit seventh, and we're in danger of saying thank you very much for listening without mentioning lots of wonderful teams in mid-table with nothing to play for. So, as I asked you at the start of the show what you're grateful for, I would like to know, out of the teams, West Ham, who of course were beaten by Fulham, who are also in this pack, West Ham, Chelsea, Brighton, Wolves, Fulham and Bournemouth, which team are you most grateful for in this Premier League season? And I'm going to go first, and I'm going to finish in a nice cyclical way with Chelsea, because thank God, aren't they hilarious? They're playing tonight against Everton. Who knows what's going to happen? Who knows? Everton might win 9-0, and it wouldn't even be that surprising, and Mauricio Pochettino will do something else Alan Partridge-esque, and I will enjoy it very, very much. Gregor, who are you most grateful for in that pack?
Well, because Alison will go for Fulham, I'll go for Bournemouth. Because... they were great. Yeah. They were great. And as I said, you know what you're getting from them now. And although it was a shaky start, I don't think they won in six, their opening six games. You know, there's a whole thing about replacing Gary O'Neill, with the merits of that. We're now, Bournemouth are in a really good place as a football club. They've got a young squad with like room for development. They've got an owner who's willing to invest. They've got a new training ground opening, I think, at Christmas. They've got a new stadium in the pipeline across the road from the current one. And they've got a really bright young manager.
And they're on the seaside.
Yeah, it's always sunny.
We all like to be beside the seaside. Tony, of those teams, who are you most grateful
Wolves.
For?
Wolves, Gary O'Neill.
Your mate, Gary O'Neill.
Because as Gary O'Neill told me in an interview, that he was a mascot of Millwall. He was in between me and Teddy in a photo.
Oh,
man, it was really nice.
I still, you've told me that twice.
And I inspired you to be a player and a manager.
Way to make it all about you, Tone. Alison Rudd, finishing with you. Which of those teams are you most grateful for?
If the league also included a line for artistic merit, then Fulham would be at the top of that table. They are a delight to watch.
Artistic merit, you get it all on this show. Alison Rudd, Tony Cascarino and Gregor Robertson, thank you so much for joining me. There you go, that was nice and positive, wasn't it? And listeners, the title race is still on. Join us on Thursday, we'll be talking about the Champions League and I'll be asking Martin Samuel why he still believes the title race is definitely still on.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.